Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions that you have left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I am kind of floating on cloud nine right now. I am very, very excited, and the reason for that excitement is not just the holiday season and all the good things that are happening, but here it is. This is my published book. My first one. I've gotten it done. I've gotten it out there, and it is available on Amazon and CreateSpace. I have left, it is called Scientology A to Xenu, and I have links for it in the notes description section below. You will be hearing a ton about this book now that it's out. I'll be talking about it a lot. In fact, I'll be making a video trailer for it tomorrow that I'll be posting. But for right now, you know, I announced this on the podcast yesterday, and I'm announcing it here today, so you can get this thing now. And just to give you a little bit of idea of what's in it, it's, you know, pretty hefty book. It clocks in about 360 pages, and I'm calling it an insider's guide to what Scientology is really all about. And some of the chapters in this book include. Why should anyone listen to me? And I talk about bitter, defrocked apostates, which is something Scientology likes to call us critics. I have a chapter here on why Scientology is imploding. Who was L. Ron Hubbard? And that chapter actually answers the question of whether I thought he, you know, thought Scientology was a con or not, and how early on that could have been occurring. I've also got some stuff in here, why Scientologists believe they are saving the world, and or here's the part about Xenu, and that chapter breaks down the entire belief structure of Scientology, including all of the upper level OT confidential levels, not just it's not just a retelling of the Xenu story, although there is more information in here about the Xenu story than I think you'll find in any other single source of information on it. I went through everything I could find, and it's all in here and a whole lot more. And then the last chapters, oh yeah, then there's also Scientology's most powerful lie about their tax exemption and tax exempt status. And the last chapters cover recovery from Scientology. There is a whole glossary in here of terms that are used and a couple appendices. Including the affirmations of L. Ron Hubbard. They're reproduced in here. So I hope that you all will take advantage of the fact that it's now available to pick it up and read it and enjoy it and let me know what you think. And of course, leave a good review for me on Amazon. So now that that news is out there, let's get on with your questions. Glenn Cameron. My question is one you have probably answered before, but I would be interested in your response. If someone who was aware of controversial aspects of the church, contents of the OT materials, Sea Org RPF stories, historical evidence of Hubbard's true life story, etc., decided they wanted to become a Scientologist, how far would they get? Would the church deem them to be irredeemable or PTS once they read N Theta and block any advancement? Or if the individual believed in the tech and agreed with the church's version of events, would the church overlook the person's transgressions in having read this information? Like many issues in Scientology, I suspect it comes down to money, with my guess being their dollars are as good as anybody's, and the church believing it is protected through the contracts new Scientologists must sign, but your knowledge would be appreciated. Well, here's the thing. If somebody wanted to become part of Scientology after reading everything like that, you know, the OT levels or the abuses that go on in the Sea Org and the RPF and all of that sort of thing, if they read about all that and then still wanted to become a Scientologist, I mean, that would surprise me quite a bit. But, you know, okay, I guess anything's possible. And if somebody was that stupid, then I guess they could, you know, go avail themselves of the services. And eventually it would come up that they had probably read some stuff about Scientology before. But if they were paying their money and doing their services and all of that exposure to that information was pre-Scientology, pre them joining Scientology, nobody would really have a whole lot to say because how would they, you know, how are they supposed to know, right? I mean, they would have a few things to say, of course. They would do some actions on the person to make sure that the person wasn't carrying forward believing any of that stuff. And, you know, they kind of grill them on it. There are some procedures they do. Like, there's something in Scientology called false data stripping, which is a one-on-one procedure that a person will receive in order to rid themselves or strip out previous false information that the person may have received on some subject or area. And it's a pretty subjective procedure because it really depends a lot on, you know, what a person considers false or not. I mean, you could false, in Scientology's world, you could false data strip somebody of all the information they learned about psychology as false information. They would just label that all false. Well, it's not all false, so it's all kind of subjective as to what is or isn't false data. So it's really just becomes a little bit more of a you know, mind control technique. But anyway, in terms of this scenario, that's about what would be done with somebody who was actively paying money and continuing to do services. Now, that's a whole different thing from if somebody is in Scientology and they go look on the internet and get information about Scientology, or they go read information that's critical of Scientology, and then they want to continue with services even though they've read that. Now, at that point, they are for it. They are going to be paying a lot of money to make up for that transgression. And the way that would be done is the person would be, you know, let's say this came up in their auditing. They confessed that they'd been looking at stuff that was critical of Scientology, and they kind of knew they shouldn't have, because everybody in Scientology knows you're not supposed to do that. So let's say they did that. They confessed to that. They would then see an ethics officer in a Scientology organization who would sit down, go over with them what they had seen, kind of interview the person, make sure, you know, what prompted you to do that, why were you looking at that information. They're going to want to know what kind of transgressions the person has committed himself that would open him up to the idea of going to look at something critical of Scientology, because as far as Scientology is concerned, people don't just do that. They do that because they've done something bad against Scientology to start with. And so then, once the person is acknowledged that they did do bad things, and that Scientology has now found out about that, they have to make up the damage for having done that, right? Did they talk to anybody else about it? That would also be a part of the handling. And then they would do amends of various kinds, and it would depend on the severity of how much they looked at and that sort of thing. Now, if an existing Scientologist were to purposefully and knowingly go look at OT material, confidential information, that's it. They're not going to be doing the OT levels ever. They're not going to be allowed access to them, because the policies of the church say that anybody who is insecure with upper level confidential information at any time is to be denied access to any further confidential secure information. And the OT materials are very definitely confidential secure information as far as Scientology is concerned. So that would be it for them as far as ever being able to do the OT levels, pretty much no matter how much they paid. I mean, you know, theoretically, I imagine there might be cases where a person could outpay that, you know, maybe if they paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars. But your general run-of-the-mill average Scientologist, that's it. And I saw that happen. That's how I can speak with such certainty about it, is I saw people who were Scientologists go on the internet, go look at information that they weren't supposed to, and then that was the consequences for it. So that's how that's dealt with, and that's kind of my complete answer to that. Anna Tuff, could you explain in more detail what the Scientology training really consists of? I know about auditing, but is that all that there is about it? I've read about word clearing and other things that didn't make any sense to me. I'm very curious to understand, what do people actually do, and what do they feel they achieve by doing so? Okay, well, this actually could take me hours to explain, because training in Scientology is a very involved process. But to summarize, to be really, really simple about this answer, basically people are taking classes. I mean, that's you know, it's what's complicated about it is all the methodologies of it and all the various things they learn. But basically, training is classes that they take. And the way that Scientology teaches classes is on a one-on-one individual basis. So they have a whole classroom of students, and there is not a teacher, but a course supervisor. And that person oversees the entire room of students. And this is something I used to do for years. And they watch the students to see if there are any indications that the students are not understanding their materials. And the materials being course packs and books and lectures, all by L. Ron Hubbard, or based on L. Ron Hubbard's works. So let's say you have, and so the way this works is the supervisor is trained to look for times when a student maybe gets drowsy, starts falling asleep, or is disagreeing with the material, or is asking a lot of questions about it. In that case, what they do is they look for what they call a misunderstood word. They look for some word or words in the text or in the lecture that the person doesn't understand. And they'll spot check them, they'll ask them the definitions of words until they find one that the person can't give an answer to, and then they'll make them look that word up in a dictionary. And misunderstood words are what Hubbard says are the primary reason why a person fails to understand something, gives up on a course of study, asks questions, doesn't understand what he's reading, is because of the words. And that's not original with Hubbard, and that's not actually Hubbard's discovery. That was something that a couple English teachers who were Scientologists gave to Hubbard as study remedies and study methodology, and he took it and made it and claimed that it was his. And he lied through his teeth about that. So that's one thing that a supervisor will watch for and will interact with students to handle. Another one is where the student has what they call a lack of mass, where they don't have the thing that they're studying about. And the way this is most easily explained is if you're studying about dogs and you've never seen a dog or heard a dog, and then reading the words about a dog and not having any mass, not having anything to connect that to, can create headaches and make your stomach feel funny and that sort of thing. Like, it actually gives you physical symptoms. And so then the remedy for that is to look at a picture of a dog, or draw a picture of a dog, or what you see in some pictures, they have clay. And they'll take the clay and mold it into a dog. And now they have some mass of a dog, right? And then the last one is, the last thing they'll look for is a confusion, or a person just, you know, being like, whoa, I just am not tracking with what's going on here. In which case they look for what that's called a skipped gradient, where the person jumped too high. You went from, you know, first grade math to calculus. It's too much of a jump. It's a skipped level, and you skip some levels in between. And that can happen in study, and that has its own, you know, thing that happens with that. Now, I've observed all of these phenomena many, 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 many times with students that I supervised. So, is it real? Well, I observed it, and I resolved it with students by looking up words, or, you know, doing the lack of mass thing or whatever. So I think there is some validity to it. And also, I'm comforted in that by knowing that it wasn't the Hubbard invention either. So I tend to give it a little bit more credence. You know, some teachers actually came up with that. Is it the be-all, end-all of study? Absolutely not. There's a lot more going on in learning and in teaching people things than just that. And so Scientology tries to reduce it down to just those three things. So those things have a lot to do with training in Scientology, and those are the way those methodologies are used extensively in Scientology training. Training is done in Scientology in order to make people learn how to be Scientology auditors, counselors, and that's what all the training is leading toward. And what you're supposed to learn in doing that and learning about being a counselor is all about the mind and all about the spirit and how life works, because Hubbard explains it all in the materials. And so by becoming an auditor, you actually learn how other people think, why they think that way, why they act that way, why people do what they do. And it's supposed to sort of give you an explanation for all kinds of things in life. Now, Scientology is not a complete dogma. There's all kinds of holes and pitfalls and things that are never taken up or answered in Scientology. So you're really left lacking, but the mantra is that it explains everything. So you keep sort of filling in the holes yourself, or you just kind of ignore them and say they're not really that important. But that's what Scientology training is, the value of what it's supposed to provide you. Whereas if you just get the auditing or the counseling in Scientology, you're not learning about your mind or about yourself spiritually. You're just relieving spiritual trauma and emotional trauma, and you're getting rid of that, but you're not learning much of anything. So the training is supposed to balance that, so you get both ends. You get, you know, spiritual gain, but you also learn what that spiritual gain is all about and what your spiritual abilities are supposed to be, stuff like that, right? That's all covered in the training side, which is why they encourage people to do it. So that's my short answer for Scientology, what Scientology training is all about. Work from home. What are your greatest and happiest moments in Scientology if you were to ignore that it was a cult and all the bad experiences you had inside Scientology? I had actually lots of good experiences in Scientology. I mean, I was doing it for decades, so of course there were some good times in there. I really did help a lot of people while I was in. There were people that I helped to get off drugs and stay off drugs. There were marriages that I personally salvaged and helped, you know, to stay together. I was very proud of having done those things, right? I felt like I helped a lot of people kind of with domestic issues or personal issues they were having that they needed help with. They needed somebody to bounce ideas off of. They needed some advice. They needed some direction. And I was there to help give that. And I was in a position where I was looked at as an authority, and so I did my best to try to be an authority and give them the assistance that they needed. And in many, many cases, I did that. So I even today look back on that and I don't look back on it and go, well, that was all just a bunch of crap, because I know I changed people's lives for the better. And I guess you could say Scientology afforded me the opportunity to do that, but really when I look back on it, I look at the idea, I look at the fact that I gave that help or I did those things almost despite Scientology rather than because of it. Because Scientology's doctrine and dogma is very authoritarian, you know, and it's very rigid. You're supposed to do this and this and this and this. And also, a lot of it is very money-centric. So a lot of the help I was giving for free. I was just sitting people down and working with them. And they couldn't afford to do services, or they weren't there on a service necessarily. And I was trying to help them to resolve the problems of their life so that they could pay more money and do Scientology, right? And a lot of that help was freely given. And that felt pretty good. But my point is that if I was rigidly in the system of Scientology as a staff member and a Sea Org member, if I had followed all the rules, then a lot of that help wouldn't necessarily have been given, because it was free. It was, you know, we weren't charging for it and that sort of thing, right? So there was some rule bending and breaking often, you know, in order to help people out. And I didn't have a problem with that, and most of the people around me didn't either, because we were all there, you know, first and foremost to help. And that urge and drive to help people is pretty powerful, you know, and it can overcome a lot of the rigid authoritarian sort of stuff that goes on in Scientology, and you kind of do it despite the Scientology. So anyway, I just wanted to clarify that too. In terms of any other personal experiences that were really wonderful for me, you know, when I was told I achieved the state of clear, I was on a high for days. I just was blown out of my head. I was so happy. I thought I'd made, you know, something that very few human beings had ever achieved, right? And that was a big moment for me. So I was genuinely very, very, very happy. And you try to, of course, when something like that happens in a world like Scientology, you know, your whole mindset goes to make yourself that way. So you try to be better, you know, and more able and more, you know, you really pump yourself up. And so you really do feel like you're fitting the mold of a clear now, you know, that sort of thing. But of course, you know, give it a week or two and the shine starts to fade and, you know, the glow starts to, you know, get some spots on it. So, but that was, you know, it was truly a happy moment at the time that it happened. So those are some moments. Grand Eclectus. I've had the misfortune of interacting with some online Scientologists. I have found them to be at the level of teenage trolls. They hurl petty insults, accuse us of crimes, act offended by anti-Scientology comments, and attempt to divert any conversation away from the wrongdoing of Scientology and onto me or other critics. Who are these people in general? Are they OSA? Are they official or public? Aren't they in danger of losing their eternity by reading all the N Theta written by critics? Are they genuinely angry, or is it just an act like Tommy Davis's mechanical I'm angry speech during the Panorama special with John Sweeney? They are hardly higher spiritual beings working towards a non-reactive mind. Well, I can't say for sure who you interacted with, because it could have been anybody, really. I mean, it might not even have been a Scientologist. But as far as the Scientologists who go online and answer questions, what I know is two things. I know, one, OSA does do that. They have personnel who deal with the internet, and they go online and they try to, you know, thwart any N Theta or bad news or critical remarks about Scientology, and they try to pump up good news about it or throw in misdirectors and get people, you know, all jumbled up and that sort of thing and distract from the original questions or critiques that the people are posting. That is definitely OSA work. OSA does do that, and the people who do that are a small trusted number of people who don't necessarily, as far as I know, I never met any of those people, so I can't say for sure a whole lot about them, except I know they exist. So, you know, are they affected by what they read? Probably over time, I would imagine that they would be. But, you know, when I interviewed Robin on my channel and talked to her about that, you know, because she did work in OSA, she explained how easy it was as a Scientologist to write off the critiques and the criticisms and whatnot. So, you know, there is a mindset there. There are also, I've heard, some public Scientologists who will go online and will try to deal with or fend off criticism because they're doing some amends project or they're trying to do good for the church, that sort of thing, right? But Scientologists, OSA or not, are pretty thin-skinned, and they don't deal with criticism well, and they don't know how to deal with criticism, because the truth is that the criticism is valid. You know, despite the beliefs, right? You can take all the stuff about Xenu and all that stuff, just park it. I'm talking about criticism about disconnection and ripping up families and stalking and harassment and the stuff that Scientology actually does that's really, really uncool. That is valid criticism, and there is no real sensible defense for those things. And so Scientologists have one or two lines that they can throw out there as justifications for the actions that Scientology does. But then after they've thrown those out and those get smashed down, that's it, they're done. They got nothing else. And they come off just, you know, looking like idiots, and so they just kind of hit the eject button and they disappear off the board or comment section or whatever it is that they're on. So that's pretty much what I know about that. It's Flash Answers time. James Smart. In the 1990s, the Exclusive Brethren made large financial contributions to the Liberal Party here in Australia, who, by the way, are actually conservative, to help John Howard become Prime Minister. This was in spite of the Exclusive Brethren's teachings of not voting or having anything to do with politics. I am also well aware of the trouble the Church of Scientology has had with the IRS. Is it common for destructive cults to make political donations and/or try to lobby politicians to get the laws or policies that they want, or just to get the authorities off their back? Absolutely. It happens all the time, all day, every day. Churches have lobbyists here in the United States, in Washington, just like any other groups. Churches are not supposed to directly get involved in politics if they want to have tax exemption. So they're not supposed to do that, but there's a lot of leeway given to churches and a lot of ministers in all kinds of denominations of churches across the land will stand on a pulpit and tell their followers, tell their flock what to do in terms of voting and who, what candidates they should support and that sort of thing. Absolutely verboten, not something they're supposed to be doing, but yes, they do it. Spike Robinson, another question for you about David Miscavige. You say he's a sociopath, and I agree, mostly. However, I've heard that children raised in cults will often develop a cult shell, which is a reflection of the leader or the leader's ideal cult member. Could the sociopathic swaggering psycho we see be merely a shell, a warped version of some part of Hubbard's ego, without the grifting, savvy, or the charm? Could there, in fact, be a very tiny, very scared child inside who knows it's all gone bad, and like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, doesn't know how to stop the ride? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know David Miscavige well enough to be able to speak about his personality or what is or isn't going on in his head. I know what he's done. I know that I've read the reports of how he acts and whatnot, and I know his history very, very well. So I would say that whether, you know, there's a little child inside his head who's, you know, wondering whether this should all be happening or not is kind of moot. Who cares? The guy beats people and takes advantage of thousands of people and rips them off and causes them to be bankrupt and destroys lives. So I could really care less about whether there's a little child inside his head who's wondering what went wrong and why the train derailed. He could get it back on the rails anytime. That's the power that he has in terms of Scientology. He's you know, Ebenezer Scrooge, right? He could see the error of his ways at any moment, and he could turn the whole thing around. And he doesn't do that every minute of the day. So, whatever. Alex Cross. Hey Chris, I'm sure that there is a bit of PTSD from the exposure to such hubristic people. I think that you are doing great in your recovery. Do you have triggers in your recovery that bring flashback memories? Not really. Not anything I could point to and say, you know, this triggers things or this, you know, triggers. No, not so much. For a very long time, I had a lot of things that would, just random things that would trigger my loss of friends, of, you know, people I loved. My ex-fiance, right, especially that one hit me really, really hard. And for a long time, all kinds of things reminded me of her. But I don't think that's so different from other people who have, you know, gotten out of relationships where they weren't the ones who wanted to leave. The other person broke it off, and then they were, you know, stuck holding the pieces and trying to figure out what just happened and try to make sense of the whole thing. It took me a long time for that to get, you know, out of that. And to this day, I guess you could say there's still some songs that I don't like to listen to because they remind me of her. But otherwise, I think I've done a pretty decent job of moving on. Molly Martin, if Tom Cruise actually blows, do you think Scientology will fair game him? Or do you think they will put as much dirt as they possibly can about him? I don't believe for a microsecond that Tom Cruise is ever, ever going to leave Scientology. I think it is part of his makeup at this point, but that's just my opinion. Were he to leave, I don't know what the church's response would be because he's so closely tied in with David Miscavige and has been put there and personified as the, you know, ultimate example of a Scientologist, more so than any other individual person in history. Tom Cruise embodies Scientology. So would they fair game him? I doubt it. You know, I doubt that they would. I think that it would be, if Tom Cruise were to leave Scientology and publicly come out and say it was all wrong and bad and that he had been deluded or under undue influence or something like that, he'd have a lot to answer for. But he'd survive it. You know, he could make restitution. He could get past that. And I don't think the church could very easily survive him leaving. And I think it would be a huge blow to the church. So you know, circumstances could be varied as to what would happen, but I don't think that you would see fair gaming or the blackmail kind of stuff going on that you see with other run-of-the-mill Scientologists. simply because of Tom Cruise's position and all of the work that's been done to make him be, you know, the public persona of Scientology. So, I don't know. That's sort of my immediate take on that. And with that, we have reached the end of another episode of Critical Q&A. Thank you very much for watching. And again, check out my book on Amazon.com. I think you will be very interested in what it has to say and what I've had to say in it. And I hope you will get one and read it. And also, you know, I hope my show here is of value to you guys, and that, you know, if you'd like, become a part of my Patreon campaign. It is what enables me to keep doing this channel and write my books, because I have two more planned for next year. 2016 is going to see two more books from me, at least as far as how I've got things planned right now, and a lot more interesting videos are coming. So I would like to continue doing this, you know, as much as I can, and your support is what enables me to do it. So that being said, thank you very much for watching. Happy holidays, and I'll see you next week.